was getting burnt out, you know, talking about policing and CRT and, you know, all the things that are wrong, you know, for us and the oppression that we experience as Black people. I wanted to start celebrating our joys, you know, our culture, the things that are really significant. And I realized that, you know, in the history of Race Talks, we've really never talked about the significance of music and art and culture as it pertains to anti-racism and advancing us as Black people. And it's literally how the movement has been advanced, right?
This is the Bris Poinsett Show. This is the Bris Poinsett Show, for the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio of the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bris Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio of the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bris Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bris Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, hey, what is good, Bris Poinsett Show family? Hi, this is Ado. First and foremost, I wanted to make this announcement real quick to say apologies for the two-week hiatus there. I was on vacation. Bruce was on vacation. We needed a moment to decompress and just kind of step away from the work in general. But now we're back at it, and we're back coming strong here with this episode with Shayna Pomerantz, and we're really excited about this. Wanted to let everyone know that this is a two-part episode as well. This part one is going to be the first half of the interview, and then next week the interview will be spliced with a fun little segment me and Bruce did together. Without further ado, please enjoy part one of this interview with Shayna Pomerantz.
This is the Bris Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial, and I have a special guest with me, Shayna Pomerantz, the executive director of Race Talk. Shayna, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in today. And we're doing something a little bit different where I got a few questions for Shayna, but actually she's going to be interviewing me because, as you'll soon see, we have a little thing coming up at Race Talks, and yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. But first, just for the people who, like, Race Talks is an institution in Portland. It's been for years, but for those who don't know, or for those who aren't familiar, who haven't been, can you just talk a little bit about the event?
Yeah, absolutely. So for folks who don't know anything about Race Talks, it's Race Talks Uniting to Break the Chains of Racism. That's the full name. It was established in 2011 by my mom, Donna Maxey. She's been hosting conversations there the second Tuesday of every month at Kennedy McMenamin School in Northeast Portland. Generally, we have conversations that are dealing with historical as well as contemporary issues, but it's always discussed through the lens of race and racism. So people who have been coming to Race Talks since 2011 generally walked into the Kennedy School gym. There was a panel discussion. There might be a movie presentation. And that's the first hour. The second hour are breakout facilitated conversations. Starting around 2016, 17, when I moved back to Portland and I got involved in Race Talks with my mom as a volunteer, we decided we wanted to create our own facilitation training program. And so we actually train facilitators on how to facilitate race-centered conversations. And so it's actually been working as a training ground for our facilitators to get monthly practice. So that's been one of the really great things that's been happening. And then over the past few years through the pandemic, we've expanded into more focus of like movies and conversations. We did karaoke and conversations. And so now we're starting to focus on art and culture through our Living Icons program and our History of Black Drag performance that's happening in June. But you're going to be joining us in July, which is actually part of a new program that we're doing where we're highlighting featured community hosts. So rather than us being the ones to actually put on the program, we are actually inviting folks to come in and say, hey, use our space and you present whatever you'd like to talk about, as long as it's through the lens of race and racism. So, and you've agreed to do that.
And I'm once again honored that, you know, you reach out to me for the opportunity. Now I'm looking forward to it. Before we talk about that screening though,
yeah.
I just wanna, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, you know, again, Miss Don Maxey, it's an institution in Portland. And I'm just curious, like, did you ever have any like trepidations about kind of like stepping into that ED role with something like that? Especially considering the family.
Absolutely. I mean, I think even before there was Donna Maxey, there was Charles and Johnny Maxey. And you know, so yes, I would say when I came back to Portland in 2016, you know, I go by Pomerantz. Maxey is also my government. I don't go by Maxey. I go by my dad's last name, Pomerantz. And so when I got here, my mom said, you know, you should go by Maxey. And I thought, well, I don't know the lay of the land just yet, you know, and when you're working professionally and people know you personally, that can be hit or miss. And so, you know, I don't look anything like my mom. And so coming into town, and I was working in the legislature at the time. And so really just trying to establish relationships and connections. It worked to my advantage to be a Pomerantz and not a Maxey. And because, you know, everybody growing, and we're going to get into this, but, you know, Portland's a small town amongst Black folks. It's even smaller. And, you know, there's history there. And so sometimes I step into relationships where people know my family and they have great feelings and positive things to say. And other times it's like, oh, okay, you're connected with those people. I'm like, yeah, but you liked me when before you knew I was connected to those people. So let's keep that going. So, you know, it's an interesting balance. I do find myself saying more so now that, you know, I'm Shayna Maxey, because it's easier than saying I'm Donna's daughter. But being an ED in general, I think is tough. And I think especially in the anti-racism work, you know, as I like to say, it's really strange to me that anti-racism doesn't pay, you know, and it's harder than just working in a nonprofit community environment. We're post 2020 riots, we're post George Floyd. People are saying, you know, we're tired of talking about racism. And my response is, well, I'm tired of living it. So, you know, if we could get on the same page there, maybe you can put me out of a job. But I don't, unfortunately, see that happening in my lifetime. So, yeah, being an ED, getting money to sustain ourselves and do this work in community, it's a lot. But I love the opportunity to step into my mom's shoes and work with her and, you know, learn from her every day.
Yeah, I love that, first off. And, you know, it's just when you're talking about not just providing a space for like important conversations, but also I think something that comes with these spaces is just the aspect of community building that, again, is so necessary.
Yeah.
Especially in a place like this. And you're also talking about training people, giving like, because facilitation is not just something you can use in that space. Like that's an actual,
it's a skill.
Yeah. It's a job skill. It's a Absolutely. Professional skill. It's also a social, a social skill as well.
Yeah.
So like Race Talks does a lot, and it's always interesting seeing that gap between all the people who very much recognize and acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes time to make the money work, you know, it's always a struggle. It's always, I mean, we're going to talk about Race Talks, but it just, it reminded me, because I saw the story a couple of days ago, like Gavin Newsom basically shutting down I want to say San Francisco have voted on like to move forward with like a reparations package. Mm-hmm. And then Gavin Newsom comes out with a statement of like, well, reparations can come out in all forms, but you know, we can't do this. And it's just like the same thing you see every time where it's like, particularly I'm just to highlight white liberals, even a lot of progressives where they're supportive to a line. Mm-hmm. And it's usually the money, but it's a, it's frustrating.
It's extremely frustrating. And I would say in our work, because there's so many amazing folks and organizations doing anti-racism and race-centered and Black-centered conversations and, you know, race talks within the, I like to say we're the gateway drug to anti-racism, you know, so we are an opportunity for people who have never engaged in conversations about race, which ironically, a lot of people still have not, you know? And so we have ground rules. We have incorporated something called progressive stacking order. So we don't just allow people to come into the space and start talking. We have a structure that we want people to utilize. And so, you know, people talk about safe and brave spaces. It's a safe space for Black and Brown folks. And again, because it's a training space for our facilitators, we don't always get it right. And so one of the things that we are working on now that we're coming back into the in-person space is really emphasizing that if you find yourself in a space and, you know, your facilitator isn't catching your eye or catching the vibe, get up, you know, leave the space, speak up, you know, because I think we as Black folks also need to practice being more vocal when we feel uncomfortable. Far too often I hear Black folks telling me, you know, and I can't believe they said X, Y, Z, you know. And my response is, well, did you say something? Well, no. Well, why not? I don't know. And again, we need practice, you know, countering the BS that we hear. So it's an interesting dynamic, but I think everybody needs to learn. I think far too often Black and Brown folks will discount the need to learn how to talk about, you know, race-centered conversations because we're living it every day. But it's a very different thing to step in as a facilitator. I have to make sure I'm not triggered, you know, or I'm feeling highly emotional as a facilitator stepping into conversations. For your event, you know, what we do is we prepare our facilitators by, if it's about a book, if it's about a film, if it's on a particular topic, we make sure that they're researching whatever it is that we're going to present. I need to facilitate on, because what we don't want to have happen is we're hearing that information for the first time. And so as the facilitator who's really setting the tone and creating, you know, kind of the vibe for the people at the table, if we're shocked or upset or getting emotional at somebody at the table, then, you know, all hell's going to break loose. Right. So it's really important to kind of check in on, okay, I can anticipate this is going to go left here. Let me plan for how I'm going to respond to that and how I'm going to step into that conversation and remember to breathe. And, you know, I can't say enough that I've been facilitating since fourth grade, you know, and so our facilitation program is really designed for young people to come in and learn how to facilitate, you know, adults in the space. And it's a very empowering thing, but it's a nonstop education that I'm 47. I'm still learning how to be better every day at doing this. So it's, but as far as the funding part, the qualifying, the quantifying of why our work matters. There are so many folks who are so much better at articulating why it's significant. And so I just fall in line right behind them and say, yes, what they said. I co-sign that 100% because it doesn't matter how it's being said. It's, you know, write a check, add some zeros, or you're racist. It's one or the other.
Oh man. Because I feel like I'm partially stalling because, again, we're kind of switching the format up. And
that's okay. I'm ready to jump questions. In. I got questions.
I know. I'm stalling a little bit because even though I interview people, fun fact for everyone, still weird for me whenever people ask me questions on the other side. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I can't explain it. But I will say just to that preparation point, because I think that's so key. Especially when you're talking about not being like, you know, sometimes those surprises, no matter what you do, they come out. It happens. But there's a lot of this stuff, a lot of wild things that get said in these spaces that you can prepare for.
Yeah.
Or that, you know, just being a Black person in any kind of like anti-racism, DEI type space in Oregon, you've had probably just like some kind of like crash course in just like, oh, that's where that can go. And yeah, being able to, again, like you said, just having facilitators prepared for that, because the people at the table are going to be following them,
right?
People like, but having it down to one, having the infrastructure and kind of like the planning to be prepared for that,
yeah,
is so key. And I feel like another thing about this work, it's just, it feels like, in addition to just like having to like advocate just to like get the funding to support it,
yeah,
oftentimes you're trying to like really get people like actually respect what goes into it, because yeah, they come in and it's just like, oh, we're going to show up and we're going to, yeah, say whatever's on our mind about race and then we're going to leave. And it's just, it's not treated with, even if it's not like an intentional, like, you know, it's not like an intentional, like mean or, yeah, thing,
yeah,
but people just don't think about it,
yeah,
with the seriousness it deserves, even though we recognize this is a problem, like an existential problem.
Absolutely.
So again, just
absolutely,
sometimes I just love when people talk about, I love talking about the how and listening, more specifically, listening to people talk about the how.
Yeah.
But,
well, I'll tell you, you know, one of the new things that we started this year was our Living Icon series. You know, I was getting burnt out, you know, talking about policing and CRT and, you know, all the things that are wrong, you know, for us and the oppression that we experience as Black people. I wanted to start celebrating our joys, you know, our culture, the things that are really significant. And I realized that, you know, in the history of race talks, we've really never talked about the significance of music and art and culture as it pertains to anti-racism and advancing us as Black people. And it's literally how the movement has been advanced, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we saw an opportunity to work with Black Butterfly and as a consultant. And this really kind of was extended through the history of Black drag. You know, we were seeing RuPaul and Poison Waters had the history of drag in Portland class that she was teaching. And it's like, oh, this is a race talks opportunity. Like, we could have a panel and have, you know, Black drag queens come and do a performance, you know, but like, how often do you actually just get to sit and talk with drag queens, you know, in our city about like, what has life been like? And so we started this last year. And so that kind of started the evening of performance and conversation. And again, it's always over a meal. So, you know, we had tickets for food and stuff for folks who attended, specifically Black and brown folks who attended. And then with the Living Icon series, the idea was, how do we give folks their flowers while they're alive to smell them? Because 3 years in the pandemic, we were losing people every day in 2020 here in Portland. And 2021, we thought it was going to get better. And then, of course, you know, more folks were going in 2022. And it just, and so the idea of having a way to honor folks who have been icons in our community. And so, you know, we had the mayor, Mr. Knowles, and Norman Boogie Cat Sylvester at our first one and in March. And then in May, we had LaRonda Steele and Shirley Nanette. And, you know, I asked Mr. Knowles in May, I said, you know, we're doing this as a fundraiser and it's a dinner and it's a catered event and it's dressed up and it's like performance and it's like really intimate. Why are we having trouble selling tickets? And because he had also just had the Albina Vision Trust had just celebrated the Cotton Club night, right? Mm-hmm. And he said they had like a waiting list of 100 people. I was like, that's phenomenal. You know, why didn't they come here tonight? That was Saturday. We doing this Tuesday. Why didn't they come over? And he said, you know, I've been trying to tell people to come, but they said, you know, I've been going to race talks for free for years. Why would I pay money to go now? And I think that's the challenge that, you know, when you're passionate about the work you do, you don't always assess your value to it up front. And if there's one thing that my mom has continuously said to me, she said, you know, I did you a disservice by not asking for money. I knew there was a value to it, but I was more invested in getting people to come to the table and have these conversations. And she'll say, you know, what she saw on January 6th, which is her birthday, she foresaw this happening, you know, and so it was imperative that we brought white folks to the table, that we got Black and brown folks talking, because we're going to be a minority majority country and all hell's breaking loose. We're already seeing this. And so we do things for free because we're passionate. We have skin in this game. We are invested in the bottom line because it's about our ability to exist and thrive as well. Not just, oh, I've got this great idea and I think it's cool. But also I have to live, and why shouldn't I live well? You know, this is really hard work that we do. Mm-hmm. Why can't I take a trip? Why can't I get a spa day on top of it? Why can't I, you know, whatever. And so I think when we start telling people what our value is and our worth, and it's like, but you always did it for free. Well, just because I did it for free doesn't mean I should have had to do it for free. And so I think I'm seeing that conversation come up, not just with white folks. Surprisingly, I'm also having it within folks in our own community. And so I think when you see folks out here doing good work, you see them working hard, write a check. If you're in the position to do it, don't create more barriers on, oh, well, I have to go through this process, or, oh, well, it requires this, or, oh, we know you're doing great work. That's why we approached you in the first place about wanting to support your work. But now we need a whole bunch of things from you that create additional barriers. And it's like, so you want me to stop the work I'm doing that I'm already underfunded and have not enough people to help me do it, to then fill out a bunch of paperwork and plead for money from you when you could just write a check and you could fill out the forms yourself. So I think that's also a real challenge to the work that I do. And so I've had to figure out, you know, from the nonprofit side, is it more about going and asking people for money, or do we just put a price point on and say the price is what it is? And if you're down with us, you support this work. And if you're not, then I'm not going to beg you to show up. I hope you'll show up. Mm-hmm. I want you to show up. You're always invited to show up. But I'm more invested in getting the work done than trying to figure out how to get you to write a check. There's other people who are really good at that. And so I would say those people who are in philanthropy, those people who are in marketing and PR and all the things, if they see folks like you, myself, we have so many organizations out here doing great work. You see these folks out here and they could use more help, then see how you can step up and say, hey, what can I do to get you a check to, you know, really enhance and bolster what you're doing? So that's my little soapbox, oh, 2 cents on the money.
No, that's something I struggle with very, very similarly in terms of like, how do you, obviously we need the funding to make these things happen.
Yeah.
And I love that point you made about like what you're doing is not, it's not like it's just, you know, some fun hobby, innocuous thing. Mm-mm. It's hard work, mm-hmm, that serves a very real and present purpose.
Yeah.
And I tend to get frustrated, to be honest with you, when we,
yeah,
devalue this, and like not in a way where it's like, oh, we say it's not important, but we devalue that work aspect of it because especially when we're talking about anti-racism, so many of the forces we're going against, these are people's jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're literally getting paid a full salary mm-hmm. with benefits
mm-hmm.
to do this work, to like suppress what you're doing.
Right.
To, you know, it's not, you know, the job description isn't oppressor,
right?
But the decisions they are making.
Well, and don't get it twisted. This DEI, EDI, whatever, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, equity, diversity, inclusion, accessibility, justice, you know, whatever the acronym is, this anti-racism work that we do, people who do that for organizations are also getting paychecks. And anytime people do trainings, that's attached to their paycheck. I need you to tap in and make it part of your life. I am not interested in what you do at your job. So, you know, I'm also a lawyer. You know, I'm not practicing, I'm not licensed, but I'm on the OCMBA, the Oregon chapter of the National Bar Association. And one of the things we do is we vet the judges who want to be on the appellate and the judiciary benches. And so one of the questions I remember asking last year, it was my first time being able to be on the asking panel. And the question was, how are you, what is your anti-racism work outside of your job? And almost everybody said, well, I do this, that, and the other to advocate for these people. And I said, but isn't that in the capacity as a lawyer? Well, yeah. What do you do outside your job? Do you know any Black and Brown people, you know, that you go have dinner with, that you have relationships with, that do you go to organizations, that you go and do advocacy work that's not on your resume, that you just show up and say, I'm going to help today, or I'm going to put down some money on this and I'm not looking for my name to show up on it? How are you doing that? And a lot of people got upset and flustered. And a few people were like, wow, you know what? I assume because this is what I've dedicated my life to, I thought this was me being active in community, but you're right. If it's attached to my paycheck, you know, because my thing is, who are you spending time in your free time? Right. Does it include people who look like the folks you serve? You know, who are you having meals with on your free time? Who are you going out with and hanging with? So that's when I know it's in your heart and you are making some real shifts. Those are the folks that I can say, yeah, you about this life. Mm-hmm. But if it's really limited to your paycheck and what you do on your job, I mean, that's great, but I don't believe that you're shifting. I don't believe you're shifting, you know, hearts and minds as an organization when you're only tracking what people are doing inside the office. I want to know what they're doing with their kids outside the office.
Yeah.
So they could come to Race Talks.
I mean, the other part about that, when we talk about
in July, when you're going to be there presenting, right? We're going to transition to that.
Just one more point.
Do folks know that you're shy, Bruce?
I'm gonna stop stalling. But it's funny because as we've talked offline about, you know, sharing the experience of having mothers who are kind of like well known.
Yep.
So in my case, my mother, Willie Poinsett, she co-founded this group, Respond to Racism, Lake Oswego, or doing conversations about racism in LO. And one of the things that, you know, has been like an offshoot of that, it's like people will get asked, you know, so what are you doing? What's your commitment to anti-racism in Lake Oswego? Right. And a lot of people, and, you know, I'm glad they support the organization by, you know, coming and attending the meetings.
Yeah.
But I do get a little weird feeling. People say, when they're like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, I go to Respond to Racism meetings.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not even a donation. That's not action. And we're like, again, thank you for supporting. Keep coming, keep engaging in the conversation. But also, I know for a fact, people have used that platform to do, because when these things do get like a critical mass, it's a place to be seen.
Right.
It's a place to gain status.
Right.
People have come through the Respond to Racism space to propel themselves to city council positions, to the mayor position, to, you know, these roles within the school district, et cetera, to, you know, get a higher profile in their business. Like, they are getting a monetary value by coming there.
Yeah.
So we can talk about what the work should be, the price point of what the work should be. Yeah. And again, different people come in with different, you know, just economic situations. But some people are definitely going in there, you know, saying, my presence here, my consistent presence here, and they're running campaigns on that. They are getting jobs. They're getting money from that.
Yeah.
And we can't pretend like that's not happening at the same time when people are trying to devalue the work. So I'll stop it there and I'll let you ask me questions, I guess. Fine. I guess I'll promote.
So you're a filmmaker.
See,
let me back up.
So, I'm in this case, I guess I am technically a producer. I can't run away from that. Filmmaker feels strong.
So you created a film that folks can view on YouTube, and it's talking about transplants, and I'm calling it Born and Raised because but say the title for the people so they know.
I call it The Black Oregonian Natives and Transplants Dinner. I go back and forth on the natives part, the obvious thing is
verbiage.
verbiage there, but I'll say I pulled the title mostly just from the conversations I see on social media where that's framed, where, you know, again, it's just going to be, that's kind of like how it's framed, how people discuss it. And again, it's a working thing where people, I don't know, sometimes when it feels like you try and polish something up too much, you get a weird response as well. So I was like, you know what, we're just going to go for the red meat here and, you know, let it be what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's.
So let's back into the conversation. So the conversation was basically kind of like a Race Talks-esque in my mind when I saw it. I was like, what? I want to do this, you know, because you convened a group of people over a meal in an intimate setting. You were basically the facilitator. And you talked about their experience of being Black in Portland as someone who is born and raised Native or someone who's a transplant. And it was a very, I loved everything about it. So we'll get into that in a second. But my question is, and you kind of allude to this when you open it up, but you know, there have been conversations on social media. We have Black Portland as a Facebook page. You mentioned Black Oregonians. I don't think I'm familiar with that page, but
I think it probably just meant Black Portland.
Okay. So Black Portland, I would say, is probably the largest page that, you know, but we also have Black Community of Portland. We have Soul Sister Sundays. Mm-hmm. We have the Black Oregon Professionals Network. I think I'm butchering that name, but there's a lot of, you know, you have BIPOC, Black Climbers group. You got hiking groups. You got Black Girls Bike. You got Black Girls Brunch. I mean, but the kind of ground zero feels like Black Portland at this point. And you were saying that there were conversations taking place in these online group settings. So what got you from the place of I'm seeing these conversations take place on social media. I'm going to convene an all Black media crew, film crew, and get a space and actually have a physical conversation. Like, take me through your process of how you got there and what that was like.
So I'll pull it back. I got beginning of 2022, because it's 2023. Yes, right. Sorry. Time.
Last year.
Time is rough. But so I was lucky enough to be one of the three recipients of Oregon Humanities Community Storytelling Fellowship.
Nice.
And like I started a series in 2021 or maybe end of 2020. Again, time is relative, called the Blacktastic Adventure, where it was just Zoom interviews basically with Black people about, you know, just the different aspects of the Black experience and different faces, not just in like Portland Metro, but also, you know, down in Medford, in Bend, Eugene. Just I've just done work over the years, you know, interviewing Black people, doing Black stories. And it's just like, I don't feel like, unless it's, you know, I used to work at the Scanner, which is one of the two historically Black newspapers, yeah. But I just want to give more of a platform to this and give people, especially as someone, like, I grew up in Lake Oswego, you know, nicknamed Lake No Negro. And I think it's, I do think it's important to give people an opportunity to, especially in these other places, like, see Black people and see us just in conversation. So anyways, fast forward back to the Oregon Humanities Community Storytelling Fellowship. I was like, this is an opportunity to at least try out doing some of this on a bigger scale. So part of that storytelling fellowship was connecting the fellows with mentors and people who could be potential partners. In this case, they connected me with Ifani Bell and Open Signal Labs, you know, renowned local filmmaker. And with, again, just the access to all the materials at Open Signal. So I was like, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. I can get this on the good cameras and all the good, like, we're talking about the dinner here, but we actually did three parts for this. One of them was this trip out to Eastern Oregon. Mm. And it just sticks with me. Like, we had one of those vans, you know, to carry all the equipment and just all the stuff, like we're loading in. It's like, how many times, like, how many of my lives is this van and everything that's in it worth right now? It's just in my mind. Cause it's just like, wow. Oh wow. We're really working with it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So
that's kind of how I feel sitting in here in the studio. I'm like, wow, this is crazy.
Right. Yeah. So with the dinner, it's just like, I want to have this conversation. As far as, like, people who've been born and raised in Oregon and people who are transplants. But, you know, I want to make sure behind the scenes, for lack of better terms, is just as Black as possible. Yeah. So we were at Louisa's, Black owned space on MLK. We had Meals for Heels catering with Nikisa Newton, you know, again, Black caterer. I literally went there today. So. Anyways,
where on MLK is it?
Actually, Meals for Heels is at the Red on Salmon, but
is that where they're based out of? Okay. Yeah. I feel like I always see them at various pop-up events.
Yeah.
And I follow them on Instagram and they're amazing. Yes. Yeah. I have to say that the special shout out that came from Mr. Bobby about how good the food is, Mr. Bobby will let you know if your food is not good. Right. So I just want to let folks know that is high praise. Getting a compliment on your food from Mr. Bobby, that is it should be like on a billboard approved by Mr. Bobby. So
you know, again, we had Louisa's, we had Meals for Heels catering, we had, you know, with Open Signal Labs, finally you got, again, like, almost all Black, like, production crew there. So it's like, you got multiple cameras, got soundstage, you got Tiara Darnell, who she flew in from Mexico to, you know, assist us with the project. So, you know, shout out to her for that. The student Nate, who came in, he was actually funny. So he was just walking by Open Signal, because it's right, basically, like, right across the street from Louisa's.
Okay.
And just ran into Ifani that day. And he's like, hey, we need someone who can, like, take photos. Because usually it would be Intizar who was on the panel, but she was on the panel with us. Mm-hmm. So that worked out as well. I bring it up, Mr. Bobby, just, like, with the people. Because I've had people ask me, you know, hey, why wasn't I invited to this thing? Which, I understand.
That's my other question.
How did you
create your panel? So I will, you know, shameless Stories Talks plug. So we had Intisar Abioto on our February panel for Race Talks. She is amazing in her own right, and also comes from an amazingly talented family. And then Mr. Bobby was one of our celebrated community living icons at our April forum. Salome, you know, is I feel like she is definitely an unsung hero in Community. Like, she is somebody who is in everything, but you seldom see her out front. And I think it was so great to be able to see her spotlighted in that, because, you know, as she mentioned, like, what do you want me to list? Is this not enough? You know, right, kind of thing. And it's like, yes, sis, you do it great. But she, when my mom was in SNF, dean of students, you know, Salome was a student. So, I mean, just kind of looking at the historical breakdown of like how we're all connected here. And the other sister who was from Florida, I'm blanking on her name, but we just met recently. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh. And I went to that event that you were talking about. I didn't know you did that. And, you know, so it was just really fantastic to see how it all came together. But what did inform your process of selecting those people specifically? Because I'm sure there was a lot of people who was mad.
Yeah. So, I mean, one, like, usually I'm the person who's not invited to things. So it's kind of funny being on the other end. But, like, also,
you didn't know you was somebody.
I will say this.
Boost you somebody, okay?
If it came off as something that people were like, hey, I wish I could have been there, and that means we did our job right.
Yeah.
But as far as picking people, so it starts with Intizar. Like, Intizar is basically like co-star, co-host of kind of like the three specials we did for that fellowship. But also, like, I met Intizar when I was working at the scanner. Mm-hmm. Met the family because they were doing sort of like a basically like vegan catering at the time, which is actually also they're responsible for what got me into vegan food.
Wow.
Also, this is an event for Karanja Cruz, and shout him out as well. But yeah, so Intizar and I for Urban League of Portland, we did State of Black Work. Well, we traveled around doing case studies for State of Black Oregon 2015. So, you know, again, we went around the state. You know, Bend, Eastern Oregon, Astoria, you know, Southern Oregon, all these places, just kind of like collecting stories. You know, Intizar, like, it was a collaborative interview process. I write up the case stories or case studies. Intizar shoots photos. And that's kind of like, that was also kind of like the impetus for doing the Black Tastic Adventure a few years later. But I knew when this project opportunity came, I was like, first person I'm reaching out to is Intizar. We got to get the band back together and do this, even though it's two people.
Listen.
So it started there. And then from there, I was like, okay, who are, and there's so many, you just meet so many amazing personalities that jump off the screen over the years. But also, I want to keep this kind of like contained, like have it. So I want everyone to have enough time to like really be able to like speak. And, you know, like, I've watched the Grapevine on YouTube over the years, you know, where they have, it seems like they have like, it was like 12 or 15 people at the table.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, again, the way like they produce that and everything is amazing.
Absolutely.
But I was like, okay, I don't know if we can have it that full.
Yeah.
But I do want to have, you know,
but I get what you're saying. Table, like, you want enough equitable airspace to go around. Cause I did know it's interesting for me now to hear that Intizar was one of the co-creators for it, because now it makes sense why maybe she held back a little bit. Cause I was like, why is she so quiet? You know? And so now that it's like, oh, okay. She's probably wearing dual hats in the moment. At least in my mind, that makes more sense now. Cause I was like, wow, she's being really quiet in this conversation.
I mean, honestly, like cause I interviewed her about the Black Portlanders around the time when she started it and, you know, just kind of like, once we got done with like the interview, that was just an extended conversation we had about, you know, her experience with family coming from Memphis and how they view Portland versus my experience having, you know, grew up in the suburbs, but going to church out here, having mom working in Portland public schools for decades.
Yeah.
You know.
And when you say Black Portlanders, just for folks who don't know, are we talking about Black Portlander, the Facebook page, or Black Portlander, the exhibit that Intizar covered and created.
Right, right.
Or so, both.
So yeah, like, I guess it started off as like a photo blog, mm-hmm. photo essay called The Black Portlanders, and has since kind of like branched off to different exhibits, different, all kinds of different projects, honestly. Yeah. You know, it's been featured on like Al Jazeera and CNN, everything. So, you know, but yeah, we're talking about that project, that award-winning project, renowned project. So that's kind of where it started. And then again, just like in my mind, thinking about how can I get, you know, who are some of, you know, just personalities again that, you know, jump off the screen. They're gonna, you know, because again, we're making a production. So you want to, like, and I say this as someone who said before, I'm shy. I can be reserved, but there's one of me there already. So we got to get these other people.
But so you had Elder, you had, you know, so Mr. Bobby, and you'll have to remind me of the names because I didn't know everybody, but Mr. Bobby is an elder, all pronoun you. So, you know, also as far as being in a wheelchair. So now we're talking about having disabled representation. Right. There's a Black, I'm just kind of going around the table, Black trans woman who from the Midwest, you know, so we have the regional representation. Then Salome, who's African, first in her family to, you know, be here, but has African roots coming from the continent. But again, the born and raised checklist. And then you've got the other sister from Florida. So we've got the South, you know, represented. And then you, of course, who's not Portland, but Portland adjacent, you know, which is, I think, a whole other conversation in terms of folks who would consider themselves from here or enough from here, Pacific Northwest. But it's like, what is Portland? So sometimes from Portland, is depending on the Black folks you're talking about, is like, are you from Albina? like, and then if you're talking to my mom, who really gets in the weeds, is like, yeah, but you were over the hill on such and such block, so you weren't even in the neighborhood, you know? You had to get busted. So it gets deep, right? And then you got the folks. And then you had the brother who was from California, where I'm from. So I'm like, okay, we got West Coast representation. And then Intizar coming also from the South, but Florida, Tennessee, different types of South, you know, because the sister from Florida says she was from South Florida. So again, different representation of Southern culture. And so it just, you know, again, I was like, wow. And then, so then I start looking at who wasn't there, right? So I'm like, I see no light-skinned people, no biracial people. So I felt like it was a very, like, unapologetically, we are Black in Portland. And I feel like a lot of times, you know, the racially ambiguous Blackness of people who come into the Pacific Northwest, oftentimes they don't know they're Black. They don't have a connection to the Black community because maybe they are adopted into a white family or they have moved here to go to school. And so most of their friends are white. And so they're trying to find the Black community. So I felt the part of the conversation was like, no, we all Black. We all come in from places where it is no question. You look at us and you know, are they Black? Could they be Black? No, we Black. And where we came from, we're Black. Where we are, we're Black. Mm-hmm. And so now we get to talk about what Blackness means. And so I really love that part of the conversation because so often we have to get into, and I think Salome talked about that, like, identifying what Black isn't, so then we can identify what Black is. And so I felt like there was no question in the conversation of who's Black, who's, right. You know what I mean? I don't know if a lot of people appreciate that, but I appreciated that.
Yeah, I mean,
was that intentional in your mind?
So as far as trying to kind of like make sure a wide range of people were represented, that was definitely very much intentional. It wasn't like, you know, I'm trying to do, you know, the whole, so I make sure, like, I'm trying to, like, meet a quota of everyone in there, but also, because I also understood, it's like, I'm not going to be able to get represent everyone
everybody right.
in this conversation.
And you couldn't do that even if you tried.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the impossible task, though.
But that said, like, if you have someone, again, like Mr. Bobby, who, again, elder, like, his presence is just, it's a big presence.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have someone like, and it kind of ranges, because, like, some of those people I've known, like, I've known Mr. Bobby just through being around, like, Black arts community in Portland for some years now. I've known Salome literally since childhood. We went to the same church. I know the whole family. Yeah. You know, then, you know, like Ken Jones, you mentioned earlier, like, I met him probably last year, and I just, like, I'm a fan of what him and Morgan Jones, no relation, but yeah, just a fan of their podcast, The Unrefined Sophisticates, as well as just the other media work they do.
Okay, that's them. Okay, because yeah. I was like, why do I know his name?
He's around.
Yeah, they are hilarious. Full disclosure, I don't fully watch podcasts. I'm terrible about it. So I'm getting better, Bruce. I'm following
there's
you.
There's a lot out there.
I don't blame anyone. I do follow Instagram and I catch the vignettes. And so I love their sense of humor. Mm. And yes, just amazing. Thank you for making that connection for me, because I was like, okay, I know there's, you know, a draw here. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. So then with like Dahlia Bell, you know, I saw her at the Black and Tours storytelling event, which is put on by Minority Retort and Jason Lamb. And
no, where was Dahlia sitting at the table?
Dahlia's a black trans woman.
In between Mr. Bobby and Salome. And then there was another sister.
Oh, yeah. And then opposite.
Chanel.
Crystal Chanel.
Crystal Chanel.
Yeah, it was from Florida. I met her at it's funny. We're doing a media, kind of like a black media event at the Albina Arts Center a couple years ago. And I think she was one of the first people who kind of like raised her hand during the Q&A. And she, because someone had mentioned a conversation sort of alluding to the transplants discussion.
Yeah.
And then she just kind of, you know, raised that up in the Q&A. And that was kind of like one of the more lively discussions after that. It's actually, and I said on the dinner too, really it was one of the impetus for doing this specifically.
Right.
Because, you know, she's talking about her experience coming from Florida.
With
working
the pronouns
in media.
And, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that too. But just like transitioning to Oregon and, you know, just some of these conversations you get, because while a big part of it was following up on just like the online discourse, it's not like, it's not a new conversation. It's not something, you know, it's something that does happen in just like passing all the time. Mm-hmm. I guess what the online part of it that stuck out is just because when people are in these comment threads, I think they feel a little more space to really, you know, say what's on their mind and like speak.
The assholes. Yeah.
That too. that's the less generous interpretation.
I mean, I'm just gonna say what I'm thinking here, Bruce, because it's true. People are rude, you know, until you get into direct,
right,
face to face contact, and then it's like, I recognize your name, you know. Oh, you was the one popping off in them comments. Do you want to talk about that now? You know, it's like, oh no.
I just wanted to, you know, again, just like assemble kind of like these personalities with people, you know, some I've known for years, some I've only kind of like met recently, but just like, I would love to have, you know, just your presence and your personality on screen for this particular discussion. And again, it like, it came together great, you know, shout out to the whole team behind it. Like, and I think, again, we're not able to, it's only like a 50 something minute conversation.
But it's packed.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And I wanted to go back to Dahlia. I don't want to jump over her. I was really surprised, like pleasantly surprised, to hear her say that as a Black trans woman, she feels safe in Portland. Because I think just recognizing that Black trans women are the most murdered Black folks in the world, and getting our community to, you know, get over their homophobia, transphobia. I would say if there was one thing that really shocked me in the scope of the conversation, that was the one I was like, really? Okay, Portland. All right. Cause I would say for all the places that I've lived, New York, I taught in the Bronx, I grew up in Oakland, I remember Portland in the 80s, you know, I feel relatively unsafe in Portland right now. And I think it's mostly the white supremacy aspect of feeling like as Black folks here, we just melanated, we walking down the street, just feel very vulnerable. And just like my head is always on a swivel. But then there's also a level of just us not acknowledging each other. I can't tell you how often I walk past Black folks and I'm like, hi, how you doing? And it's like, and I'm like, do I not look Black enough today? Like, what, you know, did you not see? I'm like, hello, I'm here. And so, but ironically, we have a lot of Black folks in the social media pages saying we don't speak to each other. And so I don't know if that's weather. I don't know if people are expecting to be ignored, so they just keep their heads down. I don't know what it is, but I'm so happy that Dahlia felt safe. I think that I was just really happy to hear that. That was amazing.
This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7, or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. Or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms, or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z.